Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
I'm Julia Tertian, host of Radio Cherry Bomb. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 135 of The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I am Sarah Kamen.
Sarah Kamen and I have not been in studio together in like 3 weeks.
Talk about a sight for sore eyes, Jesse.
Absolutely. If you could see us now.
My God, you're beautiful.
In studio today with us from the New York Times food section, Melissa Clark and Julia Moskin. In addition to reporting on all things food, Melissa and Julia also literally cook for the New York Times cooking site, posting recipes that we, the reader, can try at home. Later in the show, we're going to drop the equivalent of a morning after Pete Wells visit. The morning after quiz. As a restaurant girl, to me, a Pete Wells visit is... So
I think you just coined a new term.
Perfect. Awesome.
You heard it here first.
But first, Sari, I hear we have some really ridiculous food news this week.
Well, let me just say that 2015 so far is cray.
It's so cray. It's the year of cray.
I'm calling it now.
It's a hybrid animal.
It's bananas. Yeah, a lot going on to tell you folks about at home. So there's been a lot in the news about hanging out with cats. As we know, the infamous cat coffee shop hangout has finally opened in New York, and I'm sure lots of single women are very excited about that. And there's even more better news.
Hey, I'm a married woman, and I'm totally excited about that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I didn't say married women weren't excited. I think all people everywhere should be excited about it. I'm excited about it.
Was your significant other excited about it?
Well, he's allergic, which is why I'm excited about it.
So when you want alone time, you can go, there you go. People alone are happy to be with cats. And even better, now you can actually drink with your cats. You can do this at home, ladies and gentlemen, but mostly ladies. There's a cat wine that's from Japan. I know, shocker. It's called, excuse my pronunciation, Nya Nya Nobu. Is that racist?
You sounded like meow perfectly. Meow.
Yeah, exactly. That was my first time. Okay, so it's a wine made especially for cats. It doesn't actually contain alcohol, but it does contain juice made from Cabernet grapes. So for those lonely nights when you're sipping on your Cabernet Sauvignon, your cat can sip right there with you. And apparently it costs 399 yen or $4 for a bottle. Okay.
Wait, well, can I just say one thing?
Yes,
about this?
Of course.
As a cat owner, you are never going to get your cat to drink juice or wine. Like,
even if you tell them it's wine?
I have, like, the only human thing my cat will eat is, like, is hand-fed piece of charcuterie, and that's it.
Oh, well, maybe. Well,
what if they mix it with, like, herring juice or, like, salmon?
Herring wine would be very good.
Yes. I think it's
or
all about
maybe
the presentation.
If they watch a lot of episodes of Scandal with you,
ooh, yes,
maybe
yes.
That would persuade them that they could also be like Kerry Washington and drink huge goblets of red wine.
Yeah, don't put it in their water bowl. Put it in a wine glass.
Put it in a goblet.
Treat them nice.
I mean, I guess you just gotta just start them young. Just raise them as kittens on the line, and then you'll be able to
teach them the finer things in life from a kitten age, and you'll be fine.
So does that mean I should not let my cat eat out of the dishwasher, which is what she's been doing recently?
That's her job.
that's the finer things.
That's why you have pets, right?
If you're a cat, that is the finer things.
That sounds better than a garbage can.
She would like to eat out of the garbage can, but I draw the line there.
Oh, I hope someone on their marketing team is using that finer things in life slogan, because if not, they're missing out. Okay, this is really crazy, you guys, and I don't know how to pronounce this. Okay, something is happening in Iceland. There's an Icelandic brewery. I have no idea how to pronounce this word. It's got slashes and things. It's Stjórn. Halvor is a beer company. They make a 5.2% ABV seasonal brew. So they're making one for their midwinter month of Thori.
You and the language today is just really
anyway,
amazing.
Okay, so basically the point is they're making a beer and it's made with whale balls in this beer. This seasonal beer it's an old Icelandic tradition. It's made with lightly salted and smoked whale balls. Each individual brewing has been allotted and this is in their words, with its own bona fide fin whale testicle. And the brewery, the brewery needed to obtain a special license from the state to sell it. So the best part is the English translation of what is written on their website. Julia's face is amazing right now. Okay.
I'm just thinking about, is it the testicle itself or it the is. Contents of the testicle?
Oh, that's a good question. But I think it's actually the testicle. And this is what it says on their website. I'm assuming they use Google Translation, and Google Translation let them down. This is what it says. What makes this beer special is that its ingredients is pure Icelandic water, malted barley, hops, and sheep shit-smoked whale balls. Who said that? Icelanders have used this method of smoking for centuries. So we choose to handle the whale balls the same way before we use it in the brew. Because a lack of trees in Iceland, we use dry sheep shit to smoke. This gives the beer an excellent smoke taste. A smoke taste that you haven't tried out before. The balls also gives its flavor to the beer.
That sounds delicious.
It sounds so artisanal.
I mean, submitted without comment? I don't even know where to go.
I mean, I know people. Yes, or last week I talked about the people of Evil Twin doing a beer with frozen pizza.
Okay.
Rogue That's has done food. A beer with sriracha.
Food.
I mean, and very historically, beer is brewed with oysters, oyster shell, and oyster stout, technically.
Food.
But I don't know.
I actually love the fact that the Icelanders, they've actually gotten two great flavors into one beer. You know, not just the whale balls, not just the sheep shit smoke, but they've combined them. I think that's brilliant.
I don't
that just
know
shows
if that's
you
a typo,
how far
that is really sheep shit.
It's manure smoke.
Yeah, like I mean, it's a thing.
Essentially, peat smoked whiskey. I mean, what is peat?
Right.
Shit.
No, you're right.
That's but it's old shit. It's shit that's been, you know, sitting underground
yeah,
for a while.
Yeah, it's
like fermented,
sheep shit.
Even worse.
Yeah.
Well, maybe, but better. You know, it cleans it out.
And then smoked.
So would you drink it? I mean, if you were signed to cover it, you'd probably have to drink it.
I would try it.
Sure.
I would try it.
I mean, it's only 5.2. I mean, that's like a sessionable beer. I'm just mean alcohol percentage.
Right.
I think you could
take down a couple.
You could. Maybe if your body allows that.
I'm going to ask the white elephant question, or the blaring question in the room. Mm-hmm. How big are whale balls?
Oh yeah, but I don't know. It doesn't matter, right? If they just are brewing it in.
I guess so.
It's you're like oh, the ball.
All right.
Okay.
Moving on.
I thought the 12-year-old in the room might know.
Okay. I'm sorry, Billy.
I thought he might know the size of the whale balls.
I know, but
exactly
I just did something
the kind
really,
of thing he would know.
I made a very rude.
He's actually not looking
true.
It up
Move
on his
from
phone
that.
Either
yeah.
right now.
I forgot there was a young person here.
I knew somebody had
this
to
is see. A children's show.
He's keeping us young.
Yes. Okay. And last, but certainly not least, we're going back to Japan because that's our favorite place to find food news. A woman says a burger she ate at a Japanese McDonald's contained fragments of what looked like teeth. So this is not the first time this has happened of recent lateness. There was another burger that was discovered not too long ago to have a 1.5-inch long vinyl strip. That was a McNugget. And another hunk of plastic was recently discovered from a Sunday. Those were investigated and found to be some sort of dental materials. So Japan McDonald's has had to apologize twice in 1 week for teeth fragments, a vinyl strip, and a hunk of plastic, all related to dental materials in their food. What?
Are they all dental materials?
They are. They're all dental materials. So
what are dental
going
materials
on?
Besides teeth? That seems like it for me.
The vinyl strip and the hunk of plastic
was
discovered to come from some sort of dental tool.
So now they're going to have to put like a warning on all McDonald's food in Japan that says like this food processed in a place that also processes dental materials.
Yeah. Oh, so it was found that the white fragmented bits or something were used to fill cavities. Yuck. Why is that happening? That's not okay. But you know what? Is it any worse than what McDonald's hamburgers are made of?
I'm just amazed that McDonald's hasn't gotten on the bandwagon and started doing the more, you know, not farm to table. That sounds ridiculous to say for McDonald's. Ladies, is this on
they
the horizon
are.
For McDonald's
I,
ever?
I
are they going to
be
doing whole
oh,
white
are you
meat
kidding?
Chicken?
We're going to be having like farm to table McDonald's salad. How could we not?
Yeah, they've already pledged that they're going to start using grass fed beef in some not too far future year.
I'm pretty sure those things don't have
dental materials. Not so much grass fed. Oh, we look forward to
have an update on the whale balls.
Oh, great.
From the satellite office.
This just in.
Okay.
This just in. Up to 525 kilograms. 1.157 pounds. By far the largest testicles of any animal.
Wow. That's some nose to tail to balls beer.
I think that wraps this up.
I like it.
No, but getting back to McDonald's.
I don't know how we can finish.
She's not done.
I don't want to go back to McDonald's.
But they are, but it's been very interesting because they have, you know, I mean, what McDonald's is the ultimate target, right? It's like if you're going to get upset about anything in food that is not sustainable, you can come down really, really hard on McDonald's. And, you know, I have to say they've tried. I mean, especially in the States. But the McDonald's affiliates around the world have a much, much, much different forms of regulation. And, you know, God only knows. So.
Yes, we're happy that didn't
don't
happen.
Eat a McDonald's when you're abroad is really the sense.
Oh, and you'd be so stupid.
And why would you do that anyway?
Why would you do that?
it's like when I first came to visit New York and my friends who I visited here with from Arizona wanted to go to the Olive Garden. And I was like, we're in New York City. Why are we going to the Olive Garden? No, we can't go to... They pulled
Although,
me into the Olive
McDonald's
Garden.
In Florence serves like really nice espresso.
I'm sure like, that there's really espresso nice little, all like, over Florence.
You demi-tasse. Yeah. It's kind of fancy. On my special night out, I went there.
Well, let's take a break here.
Yeah.
Come back and we will talk to Melissa Clark and Julia Moskin from the New York Times food section.
You're listening to Lovely Seven by Mamarazzi on heritageradionetwork.org.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
We are back. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org. This is The Morning After. I am your co-host, Sari Kamen, along with my co-host,
Jesse Kiefer.
Yes. We are so excited right now because we have two of the finest food reporters in all the land. We have Julia Moskin and Melissa Clark from the New York Times food section. We are so happy you're here. How are you, ladies?
We are great.
We are well fed.
We've got pizza.
We've got cocktails.
We're talking about whale balls.
We're wearing our wool socks because we know that here at Roberto's, the temperature is a little variable.
That is true. But we're nice and cozy inside the studio. And our shipping container, things couldn't be warmer.
No, not at all.
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, it's just such an honor to have you both in the studio. And Julia, I know this is your first time on Heritage Radio.
It is.
We're popping your Heritage Radio cherry. We feel good about that. Right, Jesse?
Very good about that. Yes.
So I guess the first question right off the bat is there have been a lot of changes at New York Times. It was food and dining section. No longer is it dining section. If you could both just bring us up to speed, that would be great.
Do we want to do a little history going back to the living section?
Go for it.
Well,
yes.
So before, I mean, the Times historically changes our sections. You know, we've had dining for so long that we forget that before it was dining, it was called dining in, dining out. Ooh. And before that, it was the living section. And, you know, it's a way for the Times to have special sections targeted to advertisers, right? So food's big. So that's that. So the dining section became separated from living, which was sort of home and dining and some cult. Some
right. That was stuff. The first creation of the feature sections, which right. like was considered anathema to the New York Times. Like, no, we are a news organization. We will never, ever do that. And then I think some bold person in the 80s, of course, when like, you know, the Silver Palette was big, they're like, you know what, we really have to cover this. And so...
Yeah,
we like to think that it's not just advertiser bait, and now it is real news, and the readers certainly back that up because people, they love the dining section.
Well, as we already covered today, food is news.
Indeed. So Melissa and I have both been through several incarnations. The dining section. Now, the dining word was always controversial, and it was a little bit like pinky in the air, like, oh, we are dining tonight. We're dining in. We're dining out. So I was really glad when we went back to food, which is really what it was under Craig Claiborne, which includes dining in and dining out and cooking, which is now also it's kind of its own thing.
And also
Melissa is the queen.
And also just raw ingredients. I mean, food really covers, it's more encompassing of what we do cover, because we don't just cover cooking, we don't just cover dining, we actually cover food as ingredients, we also cover, you know, food as culture. There's a lot of different ways to cover food, and so it just makes it broader. And so we all prefer it, and it was, it came about because of the cooking product, which... Julia, why don't you take that on?
Well, talking about product at the New York Times is a very new thing because as reporters, we were supposed to be completely divorced from money. Like, we would never even have to think about the business section and what might make money. It was just like this pure little, you know, ethereal place where we were just supposed to sit and think about our stories. And now, frankly, you know, the New York Times, like other media outlets, we need to make some money. So cooking has been a massive project because, of course, we have recipes from the New York Times going back to 1851. And as you can imagine, they were in all kinds of formats. And we did not have, like, a CRM that would cover all of them. So this project like brought many, many summer interns to tears, like the effort to try to get all of the recipes in the New York Times in some kind of comprehensible format. But finally, probably, you know, who knows how they did it, but they managed to hire like 9 or 10 tech people. Not necessarily people who had food backgrounds, but people who had tech backgrounds and who could understand the data of a recipe, which is really complicated. You know, I mean, there are all these things just in terms of, you know, you measure eggs and differently from how you measure flour, differently from how you measure herbs, and what is a bunch of herbs and what is a handful. And also we had to do a certain amount of retroactive like time travel and thinking like, okay, did Craig Claiborne mean cilantro in this recipe? And did he only call for parsley because there was no cilantro in America in 1973? So all of those kinds of interpretive projects had to take place with every single recipe. Not that we really had to do that, but there were a lot of people working on it.
Well, we were there to troubleshoot. Like, hey, would this be better with cilantro? Was that the intention? Or what is, like, some of the measurements were also kind of funky, you know, dating back to especially the early part of the 20th century, you know? I mean, a handful of this, a walnut-sized piece of this, a...
A dessert spoon of sugar.
Yes, a dessert spoon. So that was where we would come
in.
So
they all had to get retested.
Some of them have gotten retested. I mean, you know, a lot of them got retested during the writing of the giant New York Times cookbook, the one that Amanda Hesser edited and slaved over. And so that was a lot of it. We also did other retesting, but not
all. Did both of you have to participate in that retesting?
It just kind of happened. You know, it was like, what are your favorite recipes? Like, what are the recipes that your mother makes from the Times? What are the recipes that you have in your bulging folder at home? And fortunately, we're both of the generation where we still had those. And so we were able to decide what we thought were Times classics. But that was pretty suggestive. That was just kind of like, well, here's what I make. Like, I make that lamb stew that Marion Burroughs published in 1981. And, you know, but the thing is that it's infinitely updatable and we can keep adding to it. Like, if you guys said, you know what, there's this thing that I always make, I would be like, cool, let's get it tested. We'll get it shot and it'll be in the product. So the product is, I mean, how many people have... I think it's like 300,000 downloads from the iTunes store, which is the app that contains all of these recipes. Now, it's by no means all of the recipes that have ever been published in the Times, but it's about 16,000 recipes that have been formatted. And every recipe going forward is going to be part of that. So that's really cool.
And on the other side of that also, aside from having this app, which you can have, there's also, it's just going into our database, just going into our cooking pages. So you can search for, you know, you can search 16,000 recipes. All of the recipes that we have are in the database. They're searchable, which is really nice, too. I mean, because you're like, what was that thing that my grandmother made? And it had noodles and raisins and, you know, whatever it was. And you can put those in and it'll come up.
Google.
Exactly. Bing, 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 bing.
Although here is a little known fact, and you don't even know who did this, but you can search the New York Times cooking database by emoji.
What?
So if you put in
it's
a little,
coolest.
What?
It is so millennial, you would not even believe. And you can put in a little pig emoji and all the pork recipes will come up.
However, there is no Kugel emoji. So you will have to use words to get the Kugel
recipe. There's also no taco emoji.
I know. I heard they're working on that. I heard a taco, I mean, that's like a thing.
That is a
taco
thing.
Emoji. That's like.
That's a yeah. Yeah. Whoever's out there listening who makes emojis, get on that.
So I want to know, so you're talking about, you know, going back through all of these recipes and like and kind of trying to find a cohesion and like a way to put them across to the at-home cook. Do you now have like a kind of an outline of language as to how, because there's several people making the, you know, doing all of these cooking recipes. You all have to follow like an outline?
You mean like a style sheet?
Like a style sheet to say this is how we portray this recipe.
No.
In the Times.
Well, there is. I mean, there are enforcers, also mm-hmm. known as copy editors, and they will do certain, you know, they do a certain amount of tweaks, but you know, it turns out recipes are so hard to standardize. It's almost impossible. I mean, they are as complicated as like nano manuals, or even more complicated, because you're just dealing with all of these physical things, and sometimes you have to chop them, and sometimes you have to reserve half, and it's impossible. I mean, we've been trying for years, and there isn't really a template that you can fit everything into. So it's proved to be really difficult. So we have taken a more laissez-faire attitude than the Times usually does.
But that's better.
Except toward anonymous sources. And it turns out that everyone can kind of have their own style. And as long as it's comprehensible and it makes sense. I mean, that's the thing. Is like, what is the most helpful to the reader? How can we most, and if that's a visual comparison, like, you know, this batter might look curdled, but don't worry about it. Or if it's just a time thing where it's like, beat it for 7 minutes, no matter how long that seems to you. Whatever is most appropriate for that recipe, that's what we use.
And that is, I think, a good thing, because I do think that your personality as a recipe writer shines through. I think that's important. I think readers do get to know what Julia means by simmer for this much compared to what I mean. And I think, or,
do you mean by simmer?
Well, I mean, it's tricky. I mean, like, for example, simmer is really one of those things where it's very subjective. You think simmer, you think, oh, I know what a simmer is. But then my husband was making whatever he was simmering, and he brought it up to what I would have called a boil. He was like, no, that's a simmer. So is it a simmer? Is it a boil? How big are the bubbles? Where are the bubbles? So I would
This is part of why recipe writing is so difficult. Yeah. Because people have no idea.
And it's funny that you never talked about that before.
one thing that we have been at least getting better on is the weight thing. You know, there's the whole, in the blogosphere, there's a whole question of weights for baking. Do we want to weigh our flour? Do we want to, or our dry ingredients? Do we want to measure them? So this is, we have very
and
long.
And if we want to weigh them, do we want to weigh them in grams or do we want to weigh them in ounces?
Exactly. So this is the kind of thing that we send, I mean, we have email chains, so many email chains about this that go round and round and round and round, and everyone has their opinions.
And then we're like, okay, we've got it. We're just going to do solids and liquids. And it's like, well, is chocolate a solid or a liquid? Melted chocolate is a liquid.
That is surprising. I mean, to your point, Jesse, I would think there would be some sort of book that it's like, day one, I'm at the New York Times, open the manual, and it's like, this is how we do it.
No, we don't even have a test kitchen. I mean, there are far more organized food publications than ours, but
well, yours is
we
really
don't like
small.
To talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. You're not kind of below the radar.
So that means test kitchen is at home.
Yes.
But, you know, there's my home, and there's Melissa's home, there's, you know, it's really pretty individual.
And I think following a recipe is very individual. Like, almost everyone, they may do it exactly by the book the first time, but then they're going to adapt it to themselves. So, I mean, what's Test Kitchen like at Chateau Moskin?
Well, I believe that at Chateau Clark, there is often an assistant of some kind. There is professionals.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
And that's not your child?
And at Chateau Moskin, it's pretty much all up to me and, you know, various amateur assistants who are in the studio with me right now.
or may not be your husband.
Yeah. Well, or more likely my son. But
hi, Billy.
It is. I mean, it's you know, recipe testing, and I did this when I was a cookbook ghostwriter. I mean, really, to properly test a recipe, okay, let's say, so you're making a recipe, and you notice, like, ooh, that's a little bit too much tomato. Now, are you going to go back and make that recipe again with less tomato and all of the other factors? I mean, it can take, like, 5 or 6 iterations. So, yes, we do it, but I don't think we do it probably as tenaciously as the people who get paid to do it. There are some recipe testers who we work with. And when it's a complicated recipe, like baking or something that really needs to be precise, absolutely, we use testers, but there are a lot more recipes that, you know, it's like, well, taste it, try it, you know, see how long you need to boil it. Is it thick yet? If it's not thick yet, then it's not ready. Most things actually, you know, work that way.
Yeah. And often is the recipe that you know you have to test, is that become your dinner?
Oh, I mean,
is that like great inspiration for what you're going to cook?
Well, all the time, but it can be really boring because you can be like, and today, again, we will be having white asparagus soup with candied violets. And everyone's like, oh no.
I kind of want to hear from Billy. What's that like to have, you know, your mom is someone who's constantly having to try recipes and you know that that's what you're going to have to eat for dinner. Like, do you not get to, you know, request very much because it's like her job?
No, I don't request very often.
And Billy, how old are you?
I'm 12.
Okay.
More often than not, we just have whatever our babysitter makes.
Busted!
But what mom usually picks out. So
do you feel like you maybe have a more refined palate than some of your classmates? Like, do you talk about food and they're like, "What is a
like?"
I've asked my friends
if they know what a tartare is, and most of them don't know.
Oh, are you kidding?
12 years old in New York, and they don't know what a tartare is?
Yeah, you better. I hope you're educating them because someone has to.
Yeah, I should educate them. I mean, a lot of the time.
Is it fun? Is it fun to have a mom who cooks so much?
Yeah. I mean, it makes for better dinners than, like, boxed macaroni and cheese.
Yeah,
like
I would
chicken
think
nuggets,
so.
But
I would think you'd be craving those things.
Oh, my God.
Let me take the mic for a moment, because there is, and I know that, you know, for many parents, it's like, oh, my child only eats white food and the box macaroni and cheese, and it's so boring. But I have to say that my children are like neophiles. Mm. And if I say, like, well, we're having the roast chicken from Ina Garten's French book, they're like, oh, but we had that.
We'd really prefer Julia Child.
Exactly.
No, but it's just like, we want something new. And I mean, that is great. That is, you know, that is fantastic.
I am so envious.
But
right
it
now.
Is a lot of pressure to come up with, you know, a dinner that, you know, that the grown-ups like and the kids like and that isn't something that everyone is tired of. And I mean, surely, you know, this is the challenge of everyone. And, you know, sorry, this is your challenge of having your dinner party last night, which is like, what has everyone not had a million times? Because you do want a little bit of a surprise and you want people to be like, oh, I haven't had that before. It's so exciting. But then also you don't want to make 7 new things for a dinner party because that's recipe for disaster.
That's true. Well, on that note, I actually wanted to ask both of you, how do you come up with your recipes? Or at least the ones that you're contributing, you know, on a daily or on a weekly basis to New York Times Cooking.
Well, we do really different kinds of recipes. Melissa does, like, new, innovative, cool recipes. So you should go first.
Well, I mean, I have a recipe column. Like, Julia also does a lot more reporting. I do very little food reporting. I do recipe development. That's pretty much my main job for the Times, is coming up with new recipes. And I really start, like, everyone starts out with, what do they want to have for dinner? Like, what are they hungry for? You know, you do it for your dinner party, you do it when you're making dinner. What am I in the mood for? And that is always my starting point. And of course, you know, what factors into those decisions that everyone else is making? Okay, is it winter, summer? Is it cold out? Do I want something, you know, hearty? Do I want something on the lighter side? What's in season? Oh, look, at the farmer's market, I can get amazing broccoli rabe, so I'm going to use a broccoli rabe. Or I really wanted to have tiny, you know, little scallops, but they don't have them. So can I do something? What would be just as good? You know, maybe I'll have shrimp or something like that. So it's the what I'm in the mood for, what's available, what's in season. Then also, what's convenient? Is it more convenient for me to cook in the early afternoon, throw it in the oven and let it, like, do a braise and let it sit for 4 hours while I, you know, whatever, I have to do something else, I have to pick up my daughter from school, or is it more convenient for me to throw something together in 30 minutes right when I get home? So all of these things, same as everyone else. The big difference is then I have to call my editor and say, so can I have this for dinner tonight? Is it okay? Like, I'm really in the mood to have this sausage braise thing. And then she'll say, you know what? David Tanis is doing sausages, so no.
Right. And you just did that 6 months ago.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't have that again.
Exactly. Like, 2 years ago, you did tofu with sausage, and now, so you know, you can't do tofu with ham. Like, but they're totally different, you know. And so it's a negotiation. So I start from the same way everyone else would start, and then it's like having, you know, someone. It's just like having a partner help you decide. Luckily, my husband is very easygoing, so you know, he'll
except for the dairy.
Except that my husband does not eat cheese, cream, or milk. He will eat butter. Butter would have been a deal breaker, I swear. But then on the flip side, if I'm cooking a recipe, you know, I'm developing a recipe, I'm like, oh, he's not going to be around. I'm going to make this one with tons of cheese in it, or, you know, and I do have a recipe tester work with me. You know, it is, part of it is because I'm in the office several days a week, and then I'm home once or twice a week doing recipes. And I always test things 2 or 3 times minimum. I mean, sometimes for baking recipes, it takes 6, 7, 8 times. And I want to maximize my at-home time. Plus, I think that I'll always cook something first, and then I'll write it out, and then I'll give it to her. And there's a whole dialogue about the difference. And I think that it just makes, I feel safer putting it out into the world, knowing that I'm not the only person who's cooked it, because it definitely changes. And so that's just my process. But I think you can cook things multiple times. I don't think you need to have a recipe tester to have a good recipe at all, but I just, it lessens my own internal anxiety. So,
but also I think what you are able to do, like with that, with your charred lemon pasta recipe, is like, if it had just been lemons, that would not have been the single most popular recipe of 2014.
I don't get it. Why that one? That's so weird. But
that's
anyway,
so delicious,
because it's so delicious, and because people think, and I think partly because people think of that as like a restaurant thing. Like, oh, I had that in a restaurant. It was so cool. I could never make that at home.
Yeah.
And that's what you do, is that you do a lot of translations.
Yeah.
And I mean, I use chefs too, because what I try to do is, especially with this series we do called Recipe Lab, which is like not reinventing the wheel, not grilling the lemons, but like, if you just want to make tartatin, or if you just want to make steak at home, how can we pull together, you know, all of the accumulated knowledge of hundreds of years of culinary history and get the single best recipe for you to do that? So that's a fun quest. And also, of course, when you work for the New York Times, people tend to return your phone call when you call them and say, we've heard that you make the most amazing tartatin, you know, how do you do it? Mm-hmm. They call you back. So that's also helpful. Mm. And that's what my recipe development is more like. That's not such an integral part of my job.
Do you want to just speak really quickly to the different nuances of your job? I mean, I know there's a lot of overlapping, but like Melissa, Good Appetite, and why are you both there? You know, I mean, obviously it's a lot of work, but you do different things.
Well, I would say, I don't know if this happens to you, Melissa, probably. So basically all civilians who are not like working for Heritage Radio assume that everyone who is a food writer is a restaurant critic.
Oh yeah, totally.
And right. I don't know how they reconcile with this, with the understanding that there is only one restaurant critic at the New York Times at one time. And if they think that I'm Sam Sifton and you're Pete Wells, I don't know how they do it. But they're always like, oh yes, I read Sam Sifton's review last week. And I'm like, no, actually you didn't, but that was okay. So, you know, that I think to many people, especially, you know, the restaurant review, and especially, you know, before the Times was so global and so national and so much about recipes, really was the arbiter of restaurants, right? Like, what restaurants are you going to go to? What restaurants are good? So I think for a lot of people, you know, especially people who don't cook, that is still the only reason that the New York Times food section exists. And in terms of what I do versus what Melissa does, I mean, I have been there for a long time. Now we're doing more recipes because of the product, the great product. But, you know, when I started out, I reported on the embezzlement at the James Beard Foundation. And that was like a huge, completely out of nowhere. I was not a trained journalist. I did not know what I was doing. I just asked some questions like, it seems weird what those people are doing over there. Like, where does all the money go? And then someone ended up in jail. That was a total surprise. And that gives you the inspiration to look at other things and be like, well, what's that? And what about that? And what is all this sushi? You know, these questions that you think of And this other story that I did that got a lot of attention about how, you know, 97% of the sushi that we eat in the United States is frozen, you know, and that just came from this feeling that, you know, oh, the sushi, it's sparklingly fresh. And over here, the sushi is also sparklingly fresh. And like, how is that possible that all of the sushi is sparklingly fresh? And it turns out that it's not. So a little bit, you develop a nose for bullshit and then you can follow it up. And those are the kinds of things that are my job, I guess I would say. And to a certain extent, trends, profiles, but, you know, we try to not stay too close to that because, you know, you can't really say like 2014 was the year of cauliflower and 2013 was the year of kale. I mean, all of these things are part of bigger pictures and we try not to get too micro. Like I would say that the macro trend is vegetables, and that's like vegetables are so much more interesting to chefs than they used to be. And they apply so much more creativity and money and thought because a protein is a protein. And if you're not going to sous vide it, they pretty much know what they're going to do. And yet vegetables are still a little bit new. So like, to me, that's one of the interesting movements, but you can't break it down to a year by year thing or like a listicle. And so those are the kinds of things that we try to follow. Like right now, I'm very interested in the question of whether chefs are really still doing nose to tail. Like, are they really still buying whole animals? Because that was so prestigious 2 years ago. And guys all over the place who were just graduating from culinary school who were like, I'm not going to buy boxed meat anymore. And I'm just going to start with the whole animal. And I'm going to serve lamb 7 ways. And it's going to be great. And I feel like I'm seeing that, like, maybe that has not worked out so well. Maybe people don't want to eat lamb 7 ways.
Well, I think also the reality of that, you know, that works for a couple, that works for maybe one half an animal.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not going to work for every single time. But just to go back to the question of, you know, when I was first hired, I was just hired on staff 2 years ago. I've been a freelancer, though, for a really long time. And originally, I wasn't doing recipes. I was really just doing trends. Like, that's all I did. Trends, trends, trends. Hey, tapioca and savory food is a trend. That was my first feature. In fact, it was in, you know, 1998.
I don't recall that.
1998.
Where was I?
Look back. I don't know. Where were you in 1998?
Not there, luckily.
And so I did that for years. But, you know, we've had different editors. And so
right,
also
that
different
was the idea of what Food News was then.
Right. And so it was this trend story. And I did so many trend stories. And the recipes that I published with those were tested recipes from chefs. They weren't my own recipe. And then as the section evolved, we got different editors and things changed. And then I started focusing in more on recipe stuff and less on trends, which is a good thing because, as Julie was saying, the trends come and go. I mean, the tapioca thing, I mean, that was like, oh, I did a big story on savory grapefruit. I mean, it's like, really? You know, some of they're so labored and they're so, I mean, really, it's just.
And you're like desperately searching, like, okay, I have 2 examples.
Exactly. A third makes it a trend.
I have to find the third one.
Right. And then you'll start calling chefs and you'll say, are you sure you haven't ever put grapefruit in savory things? I mean, really, haven't you? I mean, think about it. Call me back and try to remember.
What about your piece on schmaltz recently?
Okay, well, that's less of a trend thing, I think, that although I guess you could. I mean, I guess we.
I mean, it's been around a lot longer than maybe savory tapioca.
We call those kinds of stories deep dives into a subject. You know, something that all of a sudden people want to read about again. I don't know that I would say it's a restaurant trend, but it's like something that's on. It's in our consciousness and our sort of our. It's part of the zeitgeist. Like, oh, it's bubbling up, and then to take a deep dive, look into that, which is also, you know, and Julia does that. That's like. She does that better than anyone else. I always say, well, can you do a story like Julia does? Like, do a deep dive? When I pitch schmaltz, I'm like, can you do a deep dive into schmaltz?
Well, because to a certain extent, there are things that are constant in cooking, you know, which is great. You know, and there are certain stories that, I mean, I've only been there 12 years, 13 years, but like you can every few years barbecue, every few years pizza, absolutely. You know, there's always something more to learn. And so even though maybe we had done stories that involved chicken fat recipes, it was like, oh, we had not focused in on the schmaltz. And that is like, that's like a gift where you're like, oh, yes, there's so much to say. And we're doing a chocolate issue. Something like that is really a challenge because it's like, oh, what is there new to say about chocolate and what is fair trade? But it is one of those subjects that people are always interested in and always seems to be evolving in some sort of insane direction.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of deep dives, one of your stories just hit the Times on Wednesday about bone broth. And I want to know what you guys think. Is this the 2015 trend? How much bone broth did the family have to drink?
No more coffee, just bone broth.
That's right. That's all we have. That is a very... I was actually surprised that that did so well, because to me that was very clearly tied to the sort of paleo and pre-industrial food movement, which was really interesting for us to look into, because usually we try to stay away from diet stuff and science stuff, basically. It's like, we're all about, like, what do you want to eat? What are you going to eat tonight? What are you going to cook? And it's always about pleasure and not about deprivation. What are the things you can't eat? So for paleo, or for bone broth specifically, it was one of these things where it was like, oh my God, Alice Waters, Renee Redzepi, Marco Canora, meet crazy paleo people, you know, all over the world in Los Angeles, because everyone could come around this very simple, delicious, traditional, ancient food. But I was surprised by so many people who were like, I'm going right off to the butcher to buy my grass-fed bones, which is great. You know, it's a basic, you know, even if you're not having it as a snack, you know, having really good beef stock in your refrigerator or in your freezer is an, you know, irreproachable culinary move that will make your cooking better, even if you never drink it at all. So that one was kind of a gift.
Well, it just seemed like it was the perfectly timed next step. I mean, I think so many more people are making their own chicken broth. I do feel like I hear that more. You know, people are starting to realize that, you know what, the stuff in the box really sucks. So I'm going to try to make my own chicken broth. And so I think they're more comfortable with that. And then once you're more comfortable with making your own chicken broth, beef is the next frontier. And I think that it was such a great entree into, like, hey, you know, this is not that hard. It's really beneficial. It's really delicious. Here's some interesting history about it. And it's also timely. So it was a kind of perfect January story.
Yeah, that was a good, January story. Because, you know, people are so burned out, they're exhausted, they've cooked all these big pieces of meat, they're full, they're fat, you know. I mean, we really do not, you know, we also don't traffic in the, like, oh, this is too fattening, you shouldn't have it. But for the broth, it did seem to just be what people wanted to eat right then. And that, of course, is the goal. Like, what do people want to eat right now?
Well, can we just turn that question around? Yeah.
Great segue.
What should we be eating right now? It's cold. You know, like you said, everyone's kind of exhausted. It's, I don't know. It's just the, you know, the dog days of winter, I guess. So.
This is why you should be eating things that make you really happy. You should be eating. I mean, we were just talking about this before we went on the air, so let's talk about it again. Yeah. I don't believe that in January people should be abstemious. I don't believe in New Year's resolutions. I don't believe in eating light in the middle of January, because you know what? It's cold out there. Your body is craving rich foods for a reason.
It's so counterintuitive.
Yeah. And I mean, I also believe in being, you know, kind of like balanced and moderate all year long and make sure to eat lots of vegetables. But really, you know, if you want something, if you want a big bowl of pasta, there's a reason to eat a big bowl of pasta. It's because that's what the season calls for. So I think you should, you know, not worry about eating salads right now. Salad stuff's not that good right now. You know, eat sturdy vegetables, eat brothy things, eat pasta, eat rice, eat whatever you want to eat. Seasonally, though, what you do want to eat, I always start with vegetables seasonally, because that's, you know, so right now we're unfortunately going into the low season in New York from now until the end of May.
Pretty long.
There will be nothing. You know, it's really hard to find good vegetables. So shop at your farmer's market. And when you see something green, be it broccoli or Brussels sprouts, buy it. Don't forget about leeks. Leeks you can have. Leeks are wintered over. You know how they do leeks? Leeks are left in the ground and then they are covered over with earth for the whole winter, so that they're harvested all year long, or all season. I guess they start to come into season in the spring, then they have another season in the fall, and you can pretty much get them all year long. But in the winter, they're sitting under this pile of dirt that the farmers have put over to protect them from freezing. They get really sweet. So when you
see... carrots. Same with cabbages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so cabbage. So things like that, you know, look for those, find those, and then cook them slowly. You know, put your oven on for a really long time. It feels good. Sit next to it.
Or at least if you're going, I mean, and the thing is, you know, there is never a time I feel like when we're not supposed to be eating salad, right? I mean, but there are so many things, like if you do feel like I have to have beef bourguignon or I have to have pasta, like winter salads are so good. They really are. And, you know, it's just, you can have that balance of like richness and refreshment. And that really is what you want all year. You know, it's just like, there's no reason to like take your meals all the way in one direction and just be like, I'm just going to have soup. You know, that's not how we want to eat. You know, I mean, ideally you can have you want variety, and that's really the thing.
But with your salads are hard. I mean, you're not going to get the same greens. Like, you know, you're going to use...
No, but you have fennel.
Yeah, exactly. Fennel and
kale. And endive, like those lovely winter white salads. Love those.
Exactly. So, but you do have to like get, you know, I think a lot of people, when they think salad, they think of like a bowl of mesclun with a, you know, like baby lettuces with a dressing. And it's like, exactly what Julia said. Think fennel salad, which maybe you hadn't thought of before. Thinly, super thinly sliced.
It is also my theory that if you eat salad, you can eat whatever else you want.
Yes.
All the time. Everything. Dessert.
French fries.
Yeah.
Salad and french fries is a perfectly acceptable meal.
As long as there's wine.
Yes. And then you need your wine.
Yes.
Well, Melissa and Julia, I think we could, Sarah and I could sit here and talk to you about this forever, but sadly.
Is it over already?
No. It's not totally over, but it is time to take a break. And then we're going to come back with the morning after quiz. So get ready.
You are listening to Sunday Night Chicks by Mamarazzi.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back here on The Morning After. In studio today, Julia Moskin and Melissa Clark of the New York Times food section. It is my favorite time of the hour. I don't know about Sari's favorite time of the hour, but certainly mine.
It's my third favorite time of the hour.
Well, she's eating pizza and checking her phone, so I think it is her favorite time of the hour.
She's sitting back and taking the quiz, too. Yeah, exactly. Well, it's time for the morning after quiz. So, Julia and Melissa, you both know all about Melissa's weekly cooking column, A Good Appetite. But what do you know about Appetite for Destruction, the debut studio album by legendary hair metal band Guns N' Roses?
What do I know about it?
Well, there's going to be three questions, multiple choice. Again, no one's ever gotten these right. All of them right. So, usually two out of three, but I'm feeling good. You ladies are smart. I know this. I think you got this.
You did pick the topic that I purposely know nothing about. So yeah.
Well, how do I know that? I don't know. I mean, Guns N' Roses are pretty, you know.
It's from our time. I'm on, baby. Go.
Yes, okay, good. Julia's going to get
fantastic.
It.
Fantastic. Okay.
Gonna
get it. All right. So question one. Released on July 21st, 1987, which of these Guns N' Roses songs is not on Appetite for Destruction? All right. Is it A, Knockin' on Heaven's Door? Is it B, Mr. Brownstone? Or is it C, Welcome to the Jungle? So which is not on Appetite for Destruction? Julia?
Mr. Brownstone?
Julia says B, Mr. Brownstone. Melissa?
Knockin' on Heaven's Door.
Melissa says A, Knockin' on Heaven's Door. Melissa is correct. Knockin' on Heaven's Door. All right.
Let me just say that, Miss, I don't know anything. You didn't even hesitate on that.
I had no idea. I totally guessed. Because you know when you take a multiple choice test, you were in grade school, and they said just whatever bumps, the first thing that bumps you, that's what I did.
Go with your gut.
So I go with your gut. So okay. I went with the gut.
All right. Question two. All right. The song November Rain was originally slotted to debut on Appetite for Destruction, but they chose to take it off for what reason? Is it A, Slash's favorite guitar was stolen and they couldn't properly record in time? Is it B, they, like all good hair metal bands, felt they only needed one ballad on the album? Or is it C, they wanted the video release of November Rain to sync up with the album release, but the video's star and model, Stephanie Seymour, couldn't shoot until a later date? Julia?
I have to go with Stephanie Seymour, because I always answer Stephanie Seymour whenever possible.
That's a good way to answer, yeah. Julia says Stephanie Seymour.
I say the stolen guitar because it's so preposterous, it might be true.
The stolen guitar for Melissa? Actually, no.
Neither?
It was the ballad. They were like, we've got Sweet Child of Mine,
so we don't
need another ballad.
Not a ballad.
No.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I think
one
November
of those
Rain
two
is...
songs could I dance to at my bat mitzvah for 9 minutes straight.
Oh my God.
And that was November
because
Rain.
That's how long it was.
Wow.
You're like, oh my God, I gotta get the cute boy to dance this song. It's so long.
Did you get the cute boy to dance this song?
Oh, hell yeah.
It's your bat mitzvah.
Exactly. It's like the one chance.
All right.
March 21st. Bar mitzvah.
I'll be there.
All right. And finally, question three. During recording, what drove Axl's bandmates so crazy that they left him to record his vocals alone? Is it A, his 2-hour vocal warm-up in which he insisted the band all harmonize the Star Spangled Banner? Is it B, he refused to remove his sweaty, smelly headscarf so no one could stand and record with him in the same room? Or is it C, he forced the studio engineers to record his vocals one line at a time?
Oh, wow.
Hey, peanut gallery.
I'm going with C.
Julia says C.
A little help from the husband. All right, well, I'm gonna go with the stinky, smelly headscarf.
Actually, it is C. It is
all
C.
Right.
He actually made them record one line at a time. Come on, metal band. They can handle smell.
Oh, yeah, good point. Good point.
They had all sorts of smells.
They all seemed very plausible, though.
Good.
Well,
that's good to know.
The Star Spangled Banner was like, I was like, wow, whoever thought up that answer is really awesome.
That'd be that lady right there.
That's a great answer.
Well, actually, it was the true Guns N' Roses fan in the engineering booth, Erin Sylvester, my girlfriend. I'll give her the credit. But thank you both so much for being such good sports.
What would the prize have been?
No one's ever won yet, so we haven't decided. But I mean, I would be open to a lot of options. So we'll cross that bridge.
DJing
when we come to
at
it.
Your son's bat mitzvah. I hope
he likes a lot of Riot Girl. I would, never mind. Anyway, but thank you both so much, Julia Moskin, Melissa Clark.
Thank you.
What are your Twitter handles? I know that we can follow you.
I am at Good Appetite,
and not at a good appetite, but at Good Appetite.
Yeah.
So I run into that problem all the time. And I'm at Julia Moskin. I'm the only one.
Well, thank you so much. And if you miss them, check them out in the New York Times food section. This is The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.